Okay, good morning everyone. You had a good night's sleep? Good night rest? Yeah? Feeling refreshed? Ready for the day? Great. I reckon this is the best kind of weather, because this kind of weather you don't really want to be outside. Yeah, you want to be inside, you just want to meditate, turn inwards. It's a really good meditation weather. And this is the trick, this is one of the tricks of practicing Buddhism in the right way, is to have a positive perception, yeah, so regardless of what happens. If the weather is nice, yeah, it's beautiful. If it's raining, great for meditation. So regardless, it's positive. This is kind of the trick to get some joy and happiness in life. So now we're going to start to look at the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha. As I mentioned yesterday, the purpose of this is to kind of go directly to the Buddha himself to get some inspiration for how to practice and how to live the Buddhist life well. This is the purpose of this. And I want to first of all start off by just saying why it matters to go directly to the Buddha. Why it is not enough just to listen to various kind of teachers, but why it is so useful to go to the source, the creme de la creme, the gold standard of what Buddhism is about. So this is this very first sutta is on that particular topic, why the word of the Buddha matters so much, and why this is where the final inspiration, the final purpose really comes from. What I'm going to do, I'm just going to start reading this, and then I will comment as we go along. And if there's something you don't understand, especially if you are new to Buddhism, even if you understand the middle way, there may be other things you don't understand. Please, if that is the case, write down your questions, and then in the evening we will have the Q&A session, and we will answer the questions then. And please don't be afraid. You're allowed to ask any kind of question. Yeah, anything is okay. I promise not to be offended. And if I get offended, it is my problem. Yeah, it's my fault for getting offended. So please don't feel free to ask anything you like. Let's get started. The very first sutta. Have you all got these suttas? Yeah, everyone got suttas? Yeah. If you haven't got it, doesn't matter. I'm going to read them anyway. So you're fine. So the very first one is found in a collection of discourses called the Sangyutta Nikaya. And Sangyutta means like connected. So these are the connected discourses. And this particular sutta is from the Kassapa Sangyutta. Kassapa, you may have probably heard of Mahakassapa. Heard of Mahakassapa? The kind of one of the famous disciples of the Buddha. And Mahakassapa later on became what is known as one of the patriarchs of Chan Buddhism. And of course, Chan Buddhism is one of the main strands of Buddhism in China. Chan is just the Chinese way of saying jhana. Yeah, jhana is like meditation or whatever. I shouldn't say whatever. It is kind of the meditation in the suttas, the jhana, states of jhana. So Chan Buddhism took that name from the jhanas and used that as a name of the whole tradition. And Mahakassapa was supposed to be the first patriarch of Chan Buddhism. This is one of those things in Buddhism in China, is that they have this idea of patriarchs. Yeah, they're kind of the father figure which kind of leads that Buddhism. This is an invention in Chinese Buddhism. They didn't really have that in India. India didn't have patriarchs. This is kind of something that arose in the East Asia when it got transferred from India to China. And Mahakassapa is supposed to be the patriarch. Does that make any sense that Kassapa is the patriarch of Chan Buddhism? Does it make sense? Yes, you think it makes sense? Yeah, maybe. The problem with that, the problem with the idea of Mahakassapa being the patriarch of Chan Buddhism is that Mahakassapa was in India. He was a disciple of the Buddha. And the discourses and the kind of Buddhism that he was brought up with is the kind of discourses that we're going to be reading about now. And the kind of Buddhism you had in China, obviously it changed a little bit. Once you got to China, you had the Chinese influence, you had new developments, it became slightly different. So it doesn't really make all that much sense. But the idea, of course, is that the real patriarch, if you want a patriarch, there is only one patriarch really. And that patriarch is the Buddha. The Buddha is the patriarch of everyone else. Everything goes back to the Buddha. So that is the real patriarch. And that is the person we should look back to. Of course, the idea is, remember, the the transmission from the Buddha to Maha Kassapa is this idea of the lotus flower, isn't it? You have this lotus flower, and then he shows the lotus flower to Maha Kassapa, and he smiles, and then he's got the transmission like that. It's kind of very kind of secret and esoteric and hidden transmission of the suttas to Maha Kassapa. And these are all legends. They're not found in any real scriptures. These are legendary things, and not actually don't really have anything to do with the core Buddhist teachings. Anyway, so this is Maha Kassapa. This is the real Maha Kassapa in the suttas. And here he is in conversation with the Buddha. So this is obviously very interesting. One of the great arahants at the time of the Buddha, talking to the Buddha. So what do these arahants talk about? Yeah, it's kind of interesting. These are enlightened beings. What do they say when they talk to each other? Do they talk like us, or do they talk differently? Sounds like it's going to be profound. Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah, if two arahants talk together, arahant is fully enlightened person, you expect something profound. So this is kind of what they talk about. So this is just to get you a little bit excited about this sutta. So this sutta is called the counterfeit of the true Dhamma. So this is about how the Dhamma disappears in the future and how you get dodgy Dhamma in the future. And this is how this sutta goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in the Jeta Grove, another Pindika's park. Then the Venerable Maha Kassapa approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him. So this is a standard opening of the suttas. Yeah, thus have I heard. This is an oral tradition being passed down orally from one generation to the next one. And so it always starts with thus have I heard. It's different from the difference here is that thus have I heard does not mean it is one thing is to hear something directly or know something directly from somebody, but if it is an oral tradition passed from one generation to another one, then it's thus have I heard. The alternative is I've heard it samukka from the Blessed One. It means face to face with somebody. Face to face and thus have I heard are two opposites, if you like. So this means it is passed down by in lineage. The Blessed One is the Buddha. So now you know one more thing, apart from the middle way, you know the Blessed One is the Buddha. This is the Bhagavaha, yeah? And he was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. And Savati is one of the ancient cities of India. It's the capital of the Kosalan Republic. And the main monastery there was called Anathapindika's Monastery. It was given by Anathapindika, who was a very wealthy merchant in Savati, was given to the Buddha and the Sangha as a place to stay. And it was quite close to Savati, just outside, maybe about a kilometer outside. So easy to walk for hours into the city, and then easy to walk back again afterwards to have your meal and to have seclusion afterwards. That's kind of the ideal monastery. Easy to get alms, but also quiet from the crowds. A bit like Kaduri Center, yeah? Easy to get alms, but quite quiet. So maybe this is kind of the alternative Savati of Hong Kong, perhaps. I don't know. And if you go to India today, I think quite a few of you have been to India. Yeah, not Gerald. Yeah, you've been to India. Okay. Sylvia and Del has been to India. Great. So if you go to India, you can actually go to these places. And you can actually go to Savati. Have you been to India, Venerables? Yeah. Been there? Okay. You've been to Savati? Yeah? Okay. You go to Savati and you can get the feeling for what it is like. And actually, it is quite nice. You can see the ancient city walls of Savati and you can go to the Jeta Grove, which is not that far away. You get a feeling for what it feels like. And Savati is a very peaceful place even in the present day, except when all the tourists come. When I was in Savati last time, I think it was 10 busloads of Korean tourists that came just when we arrived. Went, oh no! And sometimes some of these tourists, they don't really understand the idea of quiet or meditation. Yeah, they come because they are Buddhists, but they're not really practicing Buddhists. They come just to have a good time and enjoy themselves. But I would like to go there just to sit down at the root of a tree somewhere, just relax and feel the atmosphere. And then you have these big loudspeakers, yeah, blaring out, blowing in some kind of saying something in Korean about, oh, the Buddha lived here, all of these kind of things. But you get some kind of feeling for going there. And if you go at the right time, if you have a good tour guide, they will take you there at the time when there are not so many tourists. And then you get a feeling for the atmosphere. Sarvati is great. Gijakuta, Vulture's Peak near Rajagaha is also very beautiful. And so some of those places are very inspiring. Anyway, so these places still exist in the present day. These are real places. They have been excavated by professional archaeologists. This is not make-believe. This is real history that we're talking about here. Anyway, so then Mahakasapa, he goes to the Buddha and he pays homage to him. Paying homage is like we do here. It's like bowing down. Abhivademi. Abhivadeti is like bowing down to someone. And then you sit down and then he says to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, what is the reason, what is the cause why formerly there were fewer training rules, but more bhikkhus and probably also bhikkhunis were established in final knowledge, while now there are more training rules, but fewer bhikkhus and perhaps bhikkhunis are established in final knowledge?" So this is an interesting question. Why are we getting more and more rules? Yeah, and why is it that fewer are established in final knowledge? Final knowledge means arahantship. Anya is the Pali word. And it means like becoming an arahant, having the full knowledge. So why is it, as time goes by, as history kind of evolves, there are less and less enlightened people, but more and more rules? Sounds terrible, doesn't it? More and more rules, but less and less enlightenment. It doesn't sound very attractive. We'd rather have more enlightenment and less rules. In the very early days when the Buddha started out, there were no rules at all. The way the rules are laid down in Buddhism, and it's also quite interesting, the way they are laid down is that the Buddha starts off with just teaching the Dhamma. All there is in the beginning is Dhamma, and then you have people hearing it, they become enlightened. And because they are enlightened, and because they are very good disciples in the early days, they don't do anything bad, they don't do anything dodgy. They are good people. But then, after a while, people, you know, dodgy people start to come into the Sangha, especially when the Sangha becomes famous. Yeah, people come in. Why do they come in? Because they want to kind of get some of the benefits of being members of the Sangha, which is so famous. What is that benefit? The benefit is lots of material well-being. Some of the monastics sometimes become very wealthy, become very well supported. You get a lot of honor and all these kind of things, because if the king kind of respects you, well, certainly ordinary people will respect you. Yeah, so you get a lot of honor, you become famous, you get all of these kind of worldly things that people often desire. So this attracts all kinds of people coming into the Sangha. Even dodgy characters come in. And in the suttas, you have some classic examples. People become monks because they are sick, for example. I'm really sick, but I can't afford a good doctor. The Sangha has a really good doctor. If I ordain, I can get rid of my sickness. So they were ordained, they become monks, they get rid of the sickness, then they disrobe again afterwards. Yeah, is that a good idea? It's terrible. Yeah, it's of course very, very bad. And this is why they had to start to lay down rules, because otherwise you get all these, it's like refugees coming into the Sangha and getting kind of sorted out and then leaving afterwards, just abusing the Sangha for their own benefit, basically. So this is how the rules start to be laid down. And over time, there are more and more rules, because there are more and more scallywags. You know the word scallywag? Kind of dodgy characters, yeah? People who are kind of have the wrong motivation, the wrong intention in ordaining in the Sangha. So you get more and more of these characters coming into the Sangha, and then of course more and more rules, less and less enlightenment, and more, and this is how then things happen. And this is still going on in the present day. You look in the present day, there's a lot of dodgy things going on in Buddhism in the present day. You have to kind of search carefully to find the few pockets. There are pockets everywhere, but you have to search them out to find the good pockets of Buddhism that is still available in the world today. And then you have more and more rules. But anyway, here Mahakasapa is asking the Buddha, why is this happening? Why is it that we have less enlightened beings? Why are there more rules? This is very interesting here, because it goes to show, if we want to have more enlightenment and awakening in the future, what is it that we have to do in the present day to achieve that? Yeah, this is what this is about. So what is it? If we want Buddhism to be prosperous, to be something which has a positive impact on our life, what is it that we have to do? Now comes the answer. Very exciting. Okay, so this is what the Buddha has to say. That is the way it is, Kassapa. When beings are deteriorating and the true Dhamma is disappearing, there are more rules, but fewer bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are established in final knowledge, in other words, in awakening. Kassapa, the true Dhamma does not disappear so long as a counterfeit of the true Dhamma has not arisen in the world. But when a counterfeit of the true Dhamma has arisen in the world, then the true Dhamma disappears. So, beings are deteriorating. Yeah, you get all of these dodgy characters coming into the Sangha and this kind of thing. Yeah. The true Dhamma is gradually sliding away. Gradually things are becoming darker. Yeah. Then this is what happens. Blessed people are enlightened there are more training rules. And then the Buddha says that it is when the counterfeit of the true Dhamma arises, that is when you have a problem. As long as the counterfeit is not there, there is no problem. But when you get a counterfeit, then people get confused. Because you have alternative teachings. Some people say the Dhamma is like this, some people say it's the other way. And then people get confused. You know what I mean? Yeah, you hear one monk saying A, and then a nun comes and says negative A. Negative A is the exact opposite of A, that's why I use A and negative A. And then, which one do you believe? One is the exact opposite of the other one. How do you know what the truth is? It's very confusing, and it gets very hard to actually know. And then you need some kind of guidance to tell you how to systematically be able to distinguish the real Dhamma from the false Dhamma, the counterfeit Dhamma. If you look around the world today, the Buddhism is so incredibly diverse. There are so many different kinds of Buddhism wherever you travel. And even within one type of Buddhism, still there's enormous amount of diversity. So do you think that there is a lot of counterfeit Dhamma in the world? I think there is lots of counterfeit Dhamma in the world, lots of problematic teachings that have nothing to do with the real thing. Recently there has been and this happens in all parts of Buddhism, wherever you go you find these problems, and sometimes you hear people reinterpreting the Dhamma from scratch, coming up with entirely new theories about what it means. Recently we had there was a Sri Lankan monk who came to Perth not so long ago, and he was saying that we had misunderstood everything. Everything was completely wrong. Everything actually should be reinterpreted completely. He has been kind of all the Mahanayakas, all the leaders of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, they have said that this monk, he should not be allowed to travel around the world anymore because the teachings he gave are so dodgy. But he's quite charismatic. He draws people in. And he says that anicca does not mean impermanence. Anicca means non-desire. Anatta, which non-self, doesn't mean non-self. It means futile. Of course, if you start like that, if some of the core concepts of Buddhism are turned upside down and they are changed completely, then of course you start having an entirely new teaching. You don't have Buddhism anymore, everything gets changed, and everything is kind of turned upside down. And this is why it is so problematic. But of course, because he is quite charismatic and is quite good at drawing in people, it means that people are still interested in these teachings. So this is kind of the problem. This is a very typical example of what happens. And this happens to be a Sri Lankan monk, but by no means is this limited to Sri Lanka. It's true everywhere. This is a universal problem. I might be a counterfeit monk, yes? You think I'm a counterfeit? I might be coming with counterfeit teachings and telling you all kinds. So be careful. Don't take my word for it. Read the suttas on your own and decide whether I'm telling you the real thing or not. So this is a universal problem. Lots of very serious distortions of the Dhamma. One of the kind of classical distortions of the Dhamma that you hear everywhere is the idea that there is an inherent essence in human beings called the Sasatavada or Sasatadhiti. The idea of permanence, the idea that something goes on forever afterwards. Very common problem in Buddhist circles. You hear it everywhere. People, they know that it's not in the five khandhas. There's something outside the five khandhas, outside of the personality, which is permanent. And that is kind of what we're aiming for in Buddhism. So lots of problems like that. It can make it very confusing and very hard to discern the real teachings. So instead of criticizing all the counterfeit Dhamma in the world, which is impossible, we can't criticize it all anyway. Criticizing is not very nice anyway. So instead of doing that, it is much more useful to try to understand what is the real Dhamma, the Saddhamma. What is the real Saddhamma? Once you understand that, you can put everything else to one side. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to try to figure out what is false and what is right. You just return to the original teachings. This is far more important. And once you do that, you realize that where you want to go is basically to what is in the Pali Suttas called the four Nikayas. Yeah, the Digha Nikaya, long discourse of the Buddha, the Majjhima Nikaya, mid-length discourses, the connected discourses, and the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. This is where you find the real authentic teachings. They are also found in Chinese. Yeah, the Agamas, you can read them in ancient Chinese, middle Chinese. Some of them are found in Tibetan language, some of them are found in Sanskrit, because these suttas, they spread out over a large area very quite early on in Buddhism. So you find them in all of these things. So these are the core, the common heritage of all Buddhist traditions that we all have in common. And if you compare these suttas across vast geographical areas and vast time gaps, they are essentially the same in the present day and they have the same source going back to the Buddha himself. And that means that you don't have to worry too much about many things. You don't have to worry too much about Abhidhamma. Yeah. So if somebody says, "Please learn the Abhidhamma," you say, "Actually, I prefer to read the suttas." It's okay to say that. Yeah, you don't have to learn the Abhidhamma. Don't have to, because often it gets very time-consuming and intellectual. Don't have to worry about all this other stuff. Yeah, Mahayana suttas. Some of them are good, some of them maybe not so good. But don't have to worry too much about them. Focus on the early texts. Focus on those things that actually go back to the Buddha himself. And we know today what those teachings are. And I've just been telling you very briefly what they are. So, the best way to avoiding the counterfeit Dhamma then is to go back to the source, read the original teachings. That is the best way, because otherwise it gets too complicated. Then the Buddha says, just as Kassapa, gold does not disappear as long as counterfeit gold has not arisen in the world. But when counterfeit gold arises, then true gold disappears. So the true Dhamma does not disappear so long as the counterfeit of the true Dhamma has not arisen in the world. But when the counterfeit of the true Dhamma arises in the world, then the true Dhamma disappears. Yeah, when you have false gold, you can no longer tell the difference. And because you can no longer tell the difference, gold loses its value because you don't know what actually is gold and what is not. Same thing with Dhamma. When you have false Dhamma, you can't tell the difference anymore. Then even the real Dhamma loses its value because you don't know where to place your faith and confidence. Even if it is available, even if it is there, you don't really know what is right and what is wrong here. It is not the earth element, Kassapa, that causes the true Dhamma to disappear, nor the water element, nor the heat element, nor the air element. It is the foolish or senseless people who arise right here who cause the true Dhamma to disappear. Foolish people, these are the Mogha Purisa. Whenever someone does something dodgy in the suttas, the Buddha says, "Mogha Purisa, don't do that, that is bad." It means like foolish person. And this is another interesting little thing. It sounds a little bit strange. It's not the earth element that causes true Dhamma. Of course, it's not the earth element. But the point here is that people who arise right here means within the sasana, within Buddhism. Yeah, so it is actually people who arise within the Buddha's teaching, within the Sangha, especially within the Sangha, that is where the problems are. The problem is not external, outside of the Sangha. It's within the Sangha itself that the problems arise. And that is interesting. Sometimes when you look at the history of Buddhism, you know, one of the very famous episodes of the history of Buddhism is when Buddhism disappeared from India. It disappeared from India in around the beginning of the 13th century, 1220 or something like that. It's about 800 years ago. That was kind of the final push, and it was almost destroyed in India. It has arisen a little bit since then, but at that time it was almost completely wiped out. And very often the Muslims are given the blame for that, yeah? And of course the Muslims did come into India and they did make a lot of havoc, a lot of destruction, because they were kind of in the expansionary phase and they were kind of expanding Islam everywhere at that particular time. They did destroy lots of universities. The famous university at Nalanda was destroyed by the Muslims. Burned down, burned all the books and killed all the monks and all that kind of stuff. So I'm glad I didn't live 800 years ago. I'd be in trouble at that time. But so they did that. But really, it's easy to blame external forces. Yeah, to say that they are to blame for what happened. It's easy because it means that we don't have to take any responsibility. But the Buddha says that is not how the Dhamma dies out. That is not the problem. Even though the Muslims may wreak havoc on you, or other people may wreak havoc on Buddhists, that is not the cause for its disappearance. The cause is internal forces within Buddhism itself. That is where it happens. And if you look carefully at Buddhist history, and you look at what started to happen after the time of the Buddha, Buddhism started to change. New ideas started to arise. Yeah, you have the idea of the Bodhisattva idea, which came after the Buddha. And you have Tantric Buddhism and all that kind of stuff. And basically what they did, they started to incorporate ideas from Hinduism into Buddhism. And you got this mixture, this syncretic religion. Syncretic means like two things kind of working together. Syncretic religion, which became the new Buddhism in India. This was part of what was being taught in places like Nalanda. So actually, the destruction happened long before the Muslims came. Buddhism was already very weak because it had been going downhill for a long period of time. So because it was very weak, it was very easy to push it over. There was no resistance left. And then, bang, it was kind of wiped out. So this shows you where we have to look for the problem in Buddhism. Yeah, in the present day you have all the problems in places like Myanmar, where you have the Rohingyas and the conflict between the Buddhists and the Rohingyas. And you have the similar kind of conflict in south of Thailand between the Muslims and the Buddhists. You have some of the same conflicts in Sri Lanka. It's everywhere. So are these external forces, are they the problem for Buddhism? Or is it internal force? Should we focus on ourselves instead? And I say we should focus on ourselves. We are the problem unless we practice in the right way. Unless we go back to the source of the real teachings. That is how we establish Buddhism for the future. That is how we get more arahants in the world. That is how we keep on rediscovering this Dhamma. And that is how we make it strong. By living the right way, by living the example, by having compassion for other people. That is the right way. Not by thinking that the Muslims are the problem. The Muslims are not really the problem. They're just trying to survive in their own way. The problem is internal to Buddhism. It's a very powerful lesson. And it shows you what actually matters in this world. How we can look after this wonderful, beautiful teaching of the Buddha, which touches on the very meaning of life. How we look after it is by living it in the right way ourselves. It's a very important lesson right there. So much in these little paragraphs when you start to pull it out. So senseless people, who arise right here in the middle of the Dhamma, they are the problem. And that is where we have to be careful. So how do we deal with those senseless people? Well, the very least, we make sure that we practice in the right way. We do the right thing. And then we become a beacon of light in the Buddhist world. So the Buddha says, the true Dhamma does not disappear all at once in the way that a ship sinks. There are, Kassapa, five detrimental things that lead to the decay and disappearance of the true Dhamma. What are the five? Here, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the male lay followers and the female lay followers dwell without reverence and deference towards the teacher. The teacher is the Buddha. It doesn't mean any teacher, it means the Buddha. They dwell without reverence and deference towards the Dhamma. They dwell without reverence and deference towards the Sangha. They dwell without reverence and deference towards the training, the Sikkha. They dwell without reverence and deference towards stillness, Samadhi. These Kassapa are the five detrimental things that lead to the decay and disappearance of the true Dhamma. So it does not disappear in the way that the ship sinks. How does a ship sink? Very fast. Once you get water in the ship, it goes glug, 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 and it can't disappear straight away. Yeah. So the ship just disappears, bang. Big cargo ship full of cargo just goes to the bottom of the ocean in no time. Like the Titanic. Yeah, the Titanic just hits the iceberg and then bang, it goes to the bottom. Yeah. We don't want the Dhamma to be like the Titanic. Yeah. So the Dhamma disappears gradually, and gradually you get the corruption of the teachings, and gradually it disappears. Yeah, and then eventually one day it's completely gone. And where are we now on that curve? We are somewhere, you know, on the kind of going downside. That's the way it looks to me anyway, going down. A little bit, goes a little bit up again, yeah. Gets a bit more popular, gets some good, and then it goes down again. But the general trend is kind of going downwards. So for that reason, it's actually an important thing to remember that things are tend to go down, and that things tend to be that, you know, go in the wrong direction. It's very useful to remember that because it gives you a sense of urgency. I often hear people say, yeah, you know, next life I'll really practice. This life I'm a bit lazy, but next time around I'll really practice. But, you know, if you're lazy now, that laziness, you're going to take it with you into your next life. You will still be lazy afterwards. Nothing is going to change. So please don't think like that. It's the wrong way. Next life, probably be even more lazy. Why? Because things tend to go down. Yeah, they go kind of downhill. And this is part of the problem. So remember that. And once you remember that, it makes you a little bit worried. If the Dhamma is going down, jeepers, creepers, this is scary. I've got to get my act together. And that is actually a good feeling. It gives a sense of urgency. Now is the opportunity. Now is the chance. You don't know whether this chance will come again in the future. Yeah. So, you know. So do things to the best of your ability now, because now is the opportunity. Things tend to go downhill. And the Buddha always predicted this. You know, many places in the suttas talks about the gradual decline of the Dhamma. It has to be like that. Everything is impermanent. Nothing lasts forever, including the Dhamma. So this is kind of the point here. But then we come to the five things that lead to the decay. And of course, this is very interesting, because this tells us something about how we can ensure things last at least a little bit longer, to kind of delay the decay a little bit, so it's not as fast as it would otherwise be. And the first thing here, it says here, it talks about the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the male lay followers and the female lay followers. So it means that everyone has a say, or everyone has a role to play in keeping the Dhamma up. This is what this means. These are the four parisas, the four assemblies. Not the four sanghas, as sometimes here, but the four parisas. And this is what makes Buddhism complete, is that all of these four parisas are still there. And on this retreat we have the four parisas. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, we're all here. It's good, isn't it? Yeah, it's really nice when all the four parisas come together, because this is what supports Buddhism into the future and makes it strong. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the last sutta that talks about the Buddha's final days, he is in conversation with none other than Mara. And he says to Mara that, Mara says to him, oh yeah, Buddha, you know, you're getting old now, you know, it's time for you to kind of go into Parinibbana and disappear, you know, you've done your job. And Mara is always kind of trying to scheme to get rid of the Buddha. And then the Buddha says, well, when I first became awakened, I said to myself, I shall not take Parinibbana until the Bhikkhu Sangha, the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the laymen and the laywomen are strong. They understand the Dhamma properly. They're able to refute the teachings of others. They're able to expound and explain the Dhamma as it actually is. When the four parisas, the four parisas have these qualities, then it is time, perhaps, for me to take my final extinguishment, the final Parinibbana. So, it's interesting. All the four parisas have a role to play in Buddhism. It's not just the monks, or not just the nuns, or not, you know, lay people too can sometimes be teachers. Lay people too have something to add to Buddhism to actually make it strong and powerful. And it's very good that we now have bhikkhunis again in the sasana, because that is one of the factors I think that will make Buddhism strong for the future. I know in East Asian Buddhism you had bhikkhunis all along, but in the Theravada Buddhism they were missing for about 1,000 years, and now they're coming back again. And what a wonderful thing that is, because in the long run it will be a tremendous benefit for the Buddhism. So that is great. And now it's only up to the bhikkhunis to practice well and do the right thing. And if they do, then that they will become a source for good. It's not difficult to become better than the bhikkhus, because the bhikkhus are so dodgy sometimes. So the competition isn't so great. But if you find your inspiration in the right place, then the bhikkhuni sangha will be a very positive force in the world. And that is a wonderful thing. Yeah. So remember that. You all have a role to play. Yeah. Every one of you, it matters. If you live well, if you do the right thing, you too will be a source for keeping Buddhism up. Or you can be part of the decline. Yeah, you can. It's kind of you can choose. What do you want to be? Do you want to be a support, or do you want to be part of the decline? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? So let's all be kind of part of the support rather than part of the decline of Buddhism. So then the Buddha says that the first reason why it declines is because we do not dwell with reverence and deference towards the teacher. Teacher is the satta. Satta is a word that the Buddha sometimes uses about himself. He is the teacher. So this is about the Buddha. Now, this, I think, already is a very important point, to have reverence and deference towards the Buddha. What does it mean? Well, what it means, one of the things that it means, is that you take the word of the Buddha as more important than any other part of any teaching that you hear from anyone else. The word of the Buddha is primary. That comes first. He is the teacher. Yeah, everyone else relies on the Buddha. They depend on the Buddha. But the Buddha is first and foremost. You may hear sometimes when I give a Dhamma talk, I sometimes refer to Ajahn Brahm, because Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. So I say, Ajahn Brahm says this, Ajahn Brahm says that, because I have a lot of confidence in Ajahn Brahm. But then I listen to Ajahn Brahm and he says, yeah, Ajahn Chah says this, Ajahn Chah says that. And then you listen to Ajahn Chah, he says, Ajahn Mun says this. And then you realize that everybody has a teacher, yeah? And it goes back and back and back. But what is the original teacher that everybody is looking back to? It's the Buddha. That's where it stops. Yeah, this is the final teacher. He's the teacher of everyone else. So instead of kind of going all these steps backwards, go straight to the source. My authority as a Buddhist monk, if I have any authority, I don't know, maybe I have a little bit of authority, and Ajahn Brahm's, any authority that we have is borrowed from the Buddha. We have it because of the Buddha. I'm wearing the robes of the Buddha. It comes from the Buddha. The Buddha is what instills or gives me that authority. If I had been sitting here, but there had been no Buddha in the world, you wouldn't be here. Yeah, you are here because the Buddha, this is what kind of gives me the authority. Yeah? If I just came off the street with long hair and a blue dress, blue kind of suit or whatever, I wouldn't have the same authority. You probably wouldn't bother sitting here. It is from the Buddha that I get this authority. If I get the authority from the Buddha, I should teach the Buddha's words. Yeah, this kind of goes together. If I don't, I'm a fraud. I'm kind of teaching you something which isn't perhaps not quite right. So this is why this matters so enormously. So if by respecting the Buddha, what it means is that in the final analysis, we go back to the word of the Buddha, we take that as our primary teaching. It doesn't mean you don't listen to anyone else. Of course we do. But what it means that this becomes the gold standard, this becomes what really shows us whether another teacher is teaching in the right way or not. This is what becomes the kind of final the final arbiter of what is the true Dhamma, if you want to. So this is the first thing that you understand, yeah, from the idea of having deference to the Buddha, that you do it in this way. And the other thing what means to have deference and reverence for a teacher, or respect for a teacher, it means that we practice these teachings. One of those other beautiful little quotes in the suttas, also found in the Mahapanibbana Sutta, is where you have all the, you know, the Buddha is just about to pass away, and there's all these kind of almost semi-miraculous, not really, miraculous is actually a Christian word, you don't really have miracles in Buddhism, but all of these wonderful events happening here. And the Buddha says, you know, forget about all those wonderful events, forget about all this bowing and all this worshipping, yeah? The real way to pay respect to the Buddha is to practice his teachings. Why? Because the reason why the Buddha teaches is not so that we can all bow down to the Buddha. The reason he does it is for us to become happy, to gain the benefit of these teachings. That is why he teaches. He teaches out of compassion. So if we don't practice those teachings, it's like he's wasting his time. So please practice. That is the way you pay reverence and deference to any teacher in this world, is by living this life. So if you're not already keeping the five precepts, please keep the five precepts. Five precepts is the foundation of Buddhism, foundation of all practice. So please take those seriously. At least keep four. If you can't keep five, keep four. If you can't keep four, at least keep three. Make the best effort you can to live this life in the right way. And then once you have kept the five precepts, then you expand out to be kind and compassionate and caring in your life. And all of these things fall in place as a consequence. This is the right way. If you want to be a good disciple of Ajahn Brahm, same thing. Ajahn Brahm will want you to practice. He will want you to be happy to gain some of the benefits of these teachings. Then you're doing it in the right way. Perhaps you think, well, why then do we bow down to the Buddha? What's the point of bowing down to the Buddha if this is how we are supposed to pay respect? And the answer is, you don't have to bow down to the Buddha. If you don't want to, don't have to. We'll see that in a second. I'll show you this later on, that even at that time, people didn't always bow down to the Buddha. You don't have to bow down to the Buddha. You don't have to bow down to me if you don't want to. It's really up to you. But the reason we bow down to the Buddha is actually because it is part of the practice sometimes. When you bow down to something worthy of being bowed down to, it helps you in your practice because it makes you a bit more humble. It makes you a bit more soft inside. It reminds you of what is very valuable in the world. If you bow down in the right way, it is an emotional uplift. It makes you feel good about yourself because there's something, you recognize there's something in the world that is really worthy of respect and really worthy of veneration and reverence. This is why you bow down. So do it with a heart. Do it with your heart. Don't just bow down like a kind of robot. One, two, three, okay, sit down. Don't do it like that. Bow down with your heart. Put your heart into it. This is something beautiful, something wonderful to bow down to other things. In the modern world, people often too many egos, too much me and mine. That is usually a very painful state of existence. Much better to live with a degree of humility, a degree of having something higher in the world that you can aspire to. Okay. So that is the reverence and deference to the teacher. There's four more factors here to have reverence and deference towards. But this session this morning is 1.5 hours long. So instead of just me going on, I think it's probably good to have a break. Nice to be able to go to the toilet and that kind of thing. So let's have a short break and come back in again in 10 minutes time at 10:25 or something. And we'll continue that here.
Very nice. Well done. Very good. Visuddha Sila, is that right? Is that Chari? Sorry. Okay. Visuddha Chari. Okay, there you go. Can you all read that? Yeah. Arahang Samma Sambuddha Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhiva Demi Bhau. Okay. That's very nicely written. I'm glad I didn't write it because it would have been completely impossible to read. So I think your handwriting is actually very, very suitable. Good.
Okay, so let's come back to the sutta again, the counterfeit of the true Dhamma. So we have just had a look at the first quality that leads to the decay and disappearance of the true Dhamma, which is lack of reverence and deference for the teacher. And the second one is they dwell without reverence and deference towards the Dhamma. In other words, the Dhamma is the teaching. This is the suttas, if you like. It's like this sutta here. This is one of those teachings. Of course, one of the things that has been very important in my monastic life, I've been a monk now for 23 years. I don't know, Ajahn Brahm has been a monk for 44 years. That's really, really cool, isn't it? 44 years, that's a lot. It's a nice kind of length to be a monk. And one of the things that have been very important for me in my monastic life has been to try to be very clear about what are the Buddha's teachings. To actually understand that, because that is what it means to have reverence and deference for the Dhamma, is to find out what did the Buddha really teach. And then to revere and to honor by reading and understanding and applying your mind to finding out what these teachings are all about. One of the great things about living in our era that we're living in now is that we have a very broad understanding of Buddhism. We know the history of Buddhism quite reasonably well. We understand the relationship between Buddhism in East Asia, China, Korea, all that, and Southeast Asia and India, and all of that. We understand how it all works out. And because we understand that, it's actually much easier to try to pull out what is the core, the essence of what the Buddha taught. And this is one of the great understandings that we have now, that even just a couple of hundred years ago or 150 years ago was much less understood. Each country, they had their own Buddhism, but it lacked the big overview of what was going on internationally and historically. So what we know, and this is what I said before, is that the real Dhamma is found in what is known as the four Nikayas or the four Agamas. The long discourses, middle-length discourses, connected discourses, and numerical discourses. So if you want to get close to the Buddha, that is what you should read. Would you like to get close to the Buddha? It's a good idea, isn't it? It's nice to get close to the Buddha. I'll talk a bit more about the Buddha later on, and you get a feeling for who the Buddha was as a person. But that is how you get close to the Buddha. That is how you become a real disciple of the Buddha, if you like. And so that is the Dhamma, basically. That's how you revere the Dhamma, by studying and understanding those teachings. The next one is then having having a reverence or deference towards the Sangha. And the Sangha here usually means the Aryan Sangha, the noble Sangha. In other words, those people who have understood these teachings, who have the same kind of insight as the Buddha has. These are the people worthy of respect. Why? Because they have the same direct experience as the Buddha, it means they have the ability to teach you the real teachings. That's why they're worthy of that kind of respect. So remember, you will never know exactly who the Aryans are. So don't. It's never about individuals. It's not about placing faith in individual people. It's about having a general sense that there are noble people out there. Of course, there are a few people who will represent that better than others. And so you include them, if you like. And there are some people who will not represent it. And you kind of put those a little bit outside. But it's not about individuals. It's about the Sangha. It's about a group of people who have this kind of insight. Never put too much of your confidence in individuals, because if you do, you very often get disappointed. Not very often, but sometimes you get disappointed. I have seen people lose so much faith, and so much in Buddhism, because they placed faith in people who didn't really have that understanding or insight, and then they end up doing terrible things, end up disrobing and disappearing, getting married and all this kind of stuff. And people lose all their confidence because it was misguided. So don't be too concerned about individuals. It's about the Aryan Sangha. It's a group of people that we're talking about. It's almost like an idea in your head, and then certain people will represent that ideal better than others. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Then we have the reverence and deference towards the training. Training is sikha in Pali. And this just means that you practice right, in the right way. You understand the importance of the training, and then you practice accordingly. And then the last one is reverence and deference towards stillness. It says concentration here, but we're not allowed to say concentration in our monastery, so I say stillness instead. And this is samadhi. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that samadhi is one of the five things that we should have respect and reverence for. It's very fascinating. And so sometimes, unfortunately, you if you do hear that people say samadhi is not so important and it's too difficult to get or whatever, remember, it's one of the things that if you don't have respect for it or reverence for it, you're actually hastening the downfall of the true Dhamma. So if you ever hear anyone teaching you pure vipassana without samadhi, then please be a little bit skeptical, because that is probably leading to the downfall of the Dhamma in the long run, if you hear these kind of things. So very fascinating right there. So there you are. These are the five things. And of course, then you have the opposite. The opposite is if you honor and you have deference and reverence towards them, then you will lead to the longevity of the Dhamma. There are five things, Kassapa, that lead to the longevity of the true Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. What are the five? Here, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the male lay followers, the female lay followers, the upasakas and upasikas, dwell with reverence and deference towards the teacher. They dwell with reverence and deference towards the Dhamma. They dwell with reverence and deference towards the Sangha. They dwell with reverence and deference towards the training. They dwell with reverence and deference towards stillness, samadhi. These kasapa are the five things that lead to the longevity, the long life of the true Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. Okay, so now you know a little bit about why I focus on the suttas, why I try to go back to the word of the Buddha, because it will be, hopefully, for the benefit of Buddhism for a long time in the future, if we do so. That is what that is all about. So that is just a little bit of background for you. Now I'm going to read out another sutta. This is quite a well-known sutta in the modern world, especially people in the West really like this particular sutta, because I guess it fits kind of Western outlook, perhaps, I'm not sure. This is often known as the Kalama Sutta, and the Kalama Sutta is about it's called the Kesaputtiya Sutta here, but it's often known as the Kalama Sutta. And it is about how to know what are right teachings and what are wrong teachings. How do we decide these things? This is very useful. Yeah. So especially if someone is new to Buddhism, how do you even know that Buddhism is right for you? How do you decide? Should I be a Christian? Should I be an atheist? Should I just believe in BMWs? What should I actually believe in this world? What actually is important? Yeah, in other words, should I be a materialist, what I mean by believing in BMWs? So this is a kind of a standard for helping us to sort things out, so to decide what is the right path and what is the right way of thinking about the world and what is a good spiritual teaching. So if you ever have a friend or a family member who is doubting, who doesn't know what they should be doing, this can come in very handy. If you yourself are doubting or uncertain, also come in handy. Yeah. Kalama Sutta. It's about how to think about spiritual teachings. So let us just dive straight into it. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering on tour among the Kosalans together with a large sangha of monks when he reached the town of the Kalamas named Kesaputta. So this was one of the things that the Buddha did a lot in those days. He would wander around the Ganges plain of the northeast of India, and he would, as he did so, he would stop in villages and towns, and he would teach the people who were there if they were interested. This is what the Buddha would do very often. And of course, sometimes he would reach places where people didn't know much about Buddhism. This was one of these places. The Kalamas were pretty ignorant about Buddhism. So he got to this place, and then when he did so, the Kalamas of Kesaputta, they heard. It is said that the ascetic Gotama, this is the Buddha, the son of the Sakyans who went forth from a Sakyan family, has arrived at Kesaputta. Now a good report about that master Gotama has circulated thus. That Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One. Let us stop there, because that is already a lot right there. So it starts out with saying the son of the Sakyans, Sakyaputta, Sakyamuni is one of the famous epithets of the Buddha. The Sakyamuni means the sage of the Sakyans, and Sakyaputta means the son of the Sakyans. And the reason why that is said is because the Sakyans were an aristocratic clan at that time. So it was kind of especially interesting when somebody from an aristocratic background, they went forth and became a samana, an ascetic. That was especially powerful. Yeah, it's like when you hear about someone who is very wealthy or very powerful or very high position and become a monk, you think, wow, what's going on? Maybe there's something to this path after all. Yeah, it's a bit like that. So there's something special going on because he was a Sakyan. So this is the first thing they hear. And then a good report has circulated. This means that he has a good reputation. He has a reputation for being an arahant, a samma, some Buddha. So this next line here, the line which describes the Buddha that comes up next, he is a blessed one, arahant, perfectly enlightened, all of this. This is a very famous verse that you find in the suttas, the Itipiso. You know the Itipiso verse? Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddha, yeah? This is this particular verse. And this particular verse is actually very important. It is very important because this is the way that the Buddha says we should recollect the qualities of the Buddha. And remember, if you recollect the qualities of the Buddha in the right way, it often gives rise to, it can give rise to inspiration, give rise to a sense of gladness, a sense of, wow, this is what the Buddha is about. This is my teacher, for goodness sake. What a wonderful thing that is. You feel inspired because you realize that you are in the presence of something very profound and very beautiful. So the Buddha says, this is how you should recollect him. And one of the things that you see straight away in that description here, it's all about qualities, about insight and conduct, yeah, about understanding, about knowledge of the world. That is what it is about. That is how we should recall the Buddha, is his abilities as a teacher, because of his wisdom and compassion for the world. There's nothing there about supernormal powers. It doesn't say the Buddha flew through the air. Wow, he flies through the air. He must be enlightened. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say anything about reading minds or all kind of other supernormal stuff. But if you go around the Buddhist world, that's what people often are interested in. But the Buddha doesn't say this is what we should focus on. What we should focus on are all of these other qualities. That already is very useful. Get to the essence. Get to those things that really matter. So what are these things? Let's have a quick look at this. I'm not going to go into too much detail because you can talk about this for a long time because it actually is quite inspiring. But first thing, he is an arahant. Yeah. Arahant means that you are worthy. Pali arahati means to be worthy of things. So what is he? What is the Buddha worthy of? Well, we saw just before that you have reverence and deference towards the teacher. Yeah, so he's worthy of respect, if you like, worthy of reverence. Why is that? Well, because he has access to an insight, access to something that all of us really should be interested in. Yeah, if you have the secret to life, if you understand happiness and suffering, if you have that which everybody else wants, then of course, if you want something from the Buddha because he can give you the answer to the meaning of life, then he's like the highest kind of teacher because he has the highest kind of insight. So like any teacher is worthy of respect, the Buddha is worthy of the highest respect for that reason. So this sense, in this sense, he is worthy. And just like a good teacher in any department, wherever you are, you know, you often treat a teacher well, or sometimes you do anyway. We tend to treat our teachers well, including our parents, at least we try to. Why? Again, because they are worthy of respect. So we do what we can to make them feel at ease, to make them feel relaxed, to make them feel that we are hospitable, we are generous, and we are caring towards the teachers. Yeah, this is what it means. They are worthy of all of these things from our side. We are just giving them a small bit, and they are giving us so much back in return. So they are worthy. Arahant is this ancient Indian word that existed in India before the Buddha came around. And it meant a worthy person. And of course, the Buddha was worthy more than anyone else. And then you have perfectly enlightened, Samma Sambuddho. So this just means that you are enlightened or awakened. You have awakened to the highest truth. Yeah, and that's really what that means. The rest of this verse actually explains more what that is about. You are accomplished, is accomplished in true knowledge and conduct. Yeah, true knowledge and conduct. What is that true knowledge? And that true knowledge, of course, is the insight of the Buddha, the understanding that he has. But to be quite specific, the suttas talk about what is called the te vijja. And the vijja here is the word that is used here for knowledge. And the te vijja are specifically the understanding of rebirth, the understanding of kamma, the results of our actions, etc. And finally, the awakening experience itself, that you actually awaken, you become an arahant, and you have a full insight into non-self and all of that. So this is what the Tevijna is about. So you basically have an insight into the nature of reality here, the nature of the world. So this is kind of nice, isn't it? Because the idea is that if we don't have insight into the nature of the world, how can you make good decisions about your life? If you don't understand what life is really like, if you don't see things clearly, how can you make good decisions about your life? How can you decide what to prioritize, what matters, what is important, if you don't have real insight into things? If you have no understanding of rebirth, for example, then the idea of rebirth, if there is such a thing as rebirth, it changes the calculation of how to live. It changes like the time span or the overview of life becomes very different. And I will talk perhaps more about this later on. So the idea of rebirth actually has very significant effects on how we lead our life and how we think about existence. And I will actually show you, I remember now, I will show you later on at least one way of thinking about that. If there is karma, if there is results of how we live now in the future, of course, it matters how we live now, not just for this life, but also for the future. It expands, it kind of changes our outlook. So these are core insights on the Buddhist path, core things about what it actually means to be awakened, to understand rebirth and karma. These are not small matters. It is not as if you can throw out rebirth and still think that you have Buddhism. If you throw out rebirth, you haven't got Buddhism anymore. These are things that are pillars. These are the kind of the foundational things that causes the Buddhist teachings to make sense. Without this, it doesn't make any sense anymore. If you take that out, the idea of awakening changes. The idea of the Four Noble Truths becomes different. The idea of dependent origination is a core teachings of Buddhism. All of this gains a new meaning. It's not the same anymore. And you have to rewrite Buddhism from scratch and you make it into a new religion. You name it after the person who kind of makes it up from scratch. So these things are absolutely core and essential things for our outlook. I mentioned outlook yesterday as part of meditation practice. Yeah, our outlook, how we look at the world, the insight we have, actually determines our ability to meditate. Which is very interesting. People don't normally realize that, because how you look at the world determines what values you have, what is important to you, what you prioritize. Yeah, if you prioritize meditation 100%, you're not going to be thinking about all this other nonsense that goes on in our minds. Yeah, I admit I also have nonsense going on in my mind sometimes. It's terrible. It's just the way things are because of our conditioning is so strong. But it reduces that nonsense. The more clarity you have, the more your outlook is aligned with the outlook of the suttas and the Dhamma. So if you see things according to reality, it helps you massively in your meditation practice because your priorities become straightened out. So these things are incredibly important. And this is the te vijja, the understanding. These are the real insights, if you like, on the Buddhist path. Until eventually you become an arahant. And then, of course, there's nothing blocking you anymore in any way. And meditation, everything becomes so easy. But what is interesting here as well is that it is not just knowledge, it is also conduct. The way you behave, the kind of person you are, changes as a consequence of your insights. So when you see things according to reality, it doesn't mean that you carry on as before. Yeah, you don't kind of carry on. If you read you go on the internet, you look at some of this, you have these self-proclaimed arahants in the world. Have you seen the website, some of these self-proclaimed arahants? It's like, my name is so-and-so, I am an arahant. And you think, wait a minute, is this what arahants do? Is that it doesn't sound like an arahant to me. Yeah? So be very skeptical. If someone says that sort of thing, be very, very skeptical. Huh? And then they say, I'm an arahant, I have this incredible insight. Yeah, and after I had this insight, well, I went back to my ordinary job and my wife, and I carried on living as before. You think, what? that doesn't make any sense. You kind of carry on. You go back to your living your ordinary life again. You kind of your married life, and you carry on with your job, and you think you're an arahant. Doesn't make any sense. The point is that if you have this kind of insight, it does something to you. It changes your psychology. You think in a different way. You become a different person. You are no longer what you were before. If someone says that on a website, on the internet, you can just dismiss it and never go back to that. Put that in a little. It kind of, you can block that website, yeah, from future access. You don't have to go there again and be kind of disillusioned by some of these weird things going on there. So this is actually a very good thing, that your conduct changes when you become an arahant, because what it means is that there is a possibility for us to distinguish those people in the world who have real insight. Why? Because they are different. They have changed. Yeah, and the way they have changed, because they have eliminated all their defilements, because they have eliminated their ego, it means that they don't get angry anymore. They don't have lots of desires. They don't have any desires anymore. They don't have an ego that needs to be satisfied or fulfilled. Instead, they are humble. They are gentle. They are always kind. They are always generous, incredibly giving. They're the opposite of selfish, always giving, 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 endlessly. They are energetic because their mind is purified. They have all of these wonderful qualities there. And when you talk to them, there's a sense of quiet and peaceful wisdom when you meet them as well. So for this reason, it is when you meet someone who is awakened, you should be a sense that there's something special about this person. There's something about this person that is different. If they are just like everyone else, then it's impossible to know. Yeah, if you just go back to work and afterwards, who knows if what you are. This is kind of a good thing. Yeah? So if you hear about someone who has got crazy wisdom, don't take it too seriously. Yeah, usually either you're crazy or you're wise. You don't have both at the same time. So be skeptical about crazy wisdom. That's what I recommend. Sometimes people who are enlightened, they can do things that are unusual, yeah. So, but not really crazy, not like getting angry, that sort of stuff. But they can sometimes be a bit unusual because because of their particular insight or whatever. So conduct and wisdom always should go together. They should have all of these good qualities. Then the Buddha is said to be fortunate. Sugato, it just means that he's happy, he has gone to a good destination, if you like. He has achieved the highest goal, yeah? So you are fortunate in that sense. I'm not sure if fortunate is the best translation, but anyway. Sugata means like gone well. Su is like good, gata is gone. So it's like good, basically, gone well, achieved. Sugati usually means gone to good rebirth. Sugata means something good in this life. He's a knower of the world. What does that mean? And what that means, it can be interpreted in different ways. And one way of interpreting it is that you understand the various kind of rebirths. Yeah, you understand the various kind of teachings and doctrines that are available, but also you understand the various types of rebirth that people can have. And that's one way of looking at it. But there is one other way, which I think is a better way of looking at this. Because one thing, although this kind of different kind of rebirths, okay, maybe, you know, it's kind of a little bit abstract and hard to relate to sometimes. But what it really means is that you understand happiness and suffering here. Because when you understand all the various kinds of rebirth, what it means that you have a full understanding of the potential for happiness and suffering in the world. If you know all the good rebirths you can have, yeah, the Brahma Loka and the Deva Lokas and all of that, you know that there is incredible happiness to be had in this world, but also it is limited. It is limited because it is impermanent, and then it stops again. It also means you know all the suffering that is available in the world, all the being reborn as an animal, yeah, or being reborn even worse, like a ghost or whatever. It's not very nice to be reborn as a ghost. So whenever you see a ghost, have compassion. Is that what you do when you have to see a ghost? Have you got compassion? Have you seen ghosts? Everyone here seen a ghost? You haven't seen any ghosts? Okay. If you see a ghost, you're so lucky. Yeah, you should be very happy to see a ghost, because if you see a ghost, you get an insight into the larger universe. Most people, we have limited our perceptions to the human realm, but if you see a ghost, suddenly you have expanded out your horizon. You say, whoa, thank you, ghost, for coming. Yeah, whoa, so cool to meet you. I've never seen a ghost before. That's what you should say when you say a ghost. Sometimes people are afraid of ghosts, but ghosts are actually, remember, ghosts, they are suffering. Yeah, they have a problem. They don't want to be ghosts. Please help me out. Do it. Make an offering on my behalf so I don't have to be a ghost anymore. Have compassion for the ghosts. And also understand that you are lucky to have an insight into a broader kind of realm of being. So this is what the Buddha sees. He sees this entire scope. Yeah? And when you understand that, you start to understand the scope for happiness and suffering in this world. If all you know is the human realm, you only have a very narrow understanding of happiness and suffering. Yeah? But now you broaden it out and you see everything. Yeah? Of course, if you're going to become fully awakened and fully enlightened, you have to have that big insight. Because you have to understand the full scope of suffering and happiness to be able to decide whether you should leave it all behind or whether it is worthwhile carrying on in the human realm or whatever. So it is a full insight into suffering and happiness. That is what knower of the world means, in my opinion, in its deepest sense. And then the Buddha can kind of make a decision on what is right and what he should be doing. I don't know if it makes any sense to you, the idea of devas and gods and ghosts, whether you think that's complete rubbish or whether you think it is. Some people think it's complete rubbish. I think it's. I have no doubt that it's true, but maybe some of you think it's complete nonsense. Remember, it may sound strange, yeah? A god, what is a god? What's that got to do with me? But remember, it is not that strange at all. It is just like in the human realm, you have some human beings who are very powerful and have a lot of material wealth or even are very happy. Yeah, and then you have some human beings who are really poor and really terrible, who are sick and afflicted, have no education and no wisdom and nothing like that. There's a vast difference in the human realm. And for the person in the human realm who is at the very bottom, in the worst position, when they look at the kind of the people who are most powerful and most wealthy, they look like gods to them. Almost. Yeah, it's almost like gods. That's what it means to be a god. If you get reborn as a god in your next life, is that what you would like to be? Anyone who would like to be a god in the next life? Sounds good, yeah? If you get reborn as a god as in your next life, it just means that suddenly there you are. Whoop! I'm a god now. Wow, okay, cool. That's what it means, yeah? It's not something strange or different. It's just suddenly you are there, finding yourself in it. You have a slightly different body. You feel more happiness. You have more kind of all the good things in the world. But it's like you have been elevated up, yeah? You have been kind of, that's really all it means. Or if you get reborn as a ghost, you think, oh, I'm a ghost now. Gee, that's really unfortunate. I don't really want to be a ghost. And then you kind of go to your parents, yeah, and so you try to knock on their door, yeah, and they say, oh no, help, a ghost, and they get really afraid of you, but you would like them to make some merit for you. No, please don't be afraid, I just want you to make some merit for me, don't run away. Yeah, this is what happens. So when you see a ghost, remember that, don't be afraid, make some merit for them instead. Go to the monastery and do an act of offering, because the ghost is trying to find some happiness in life. So this is what it's like. It's just an expansion of our ordinary human view of things. Human realm already has a certain width to it. This is expanding it out, yeah? Making more room for happiness and suffering. That's really all it is. It is not strange at all. If you get reborn into one of these realms, there you are. It is completely natural. Nothing weird about it at all. So this is the right way of thinking about these other realms. And then you get this scope. And this is what the Buddha had insight into. So he has a full understanding of happiness and suffering. And that's pretty good, to have full understanding into happiness and suffering. Why? Because this is what everyone is after. Yeah, what is life all about? If you think about your life, you think about what you are searching for in life, everyone is looking for solution to problems, getting out of difficulties, finding a reasonably happy life. Everyone is looking for that. If you look at what your life, look at the things that you crave for, the things that you wish for in your life, if you're looking at your relationships, your jobs, your idea, what life is all about, it's all about that, moving towards more satisfaction, more contentment, more happiness, less suffering, less problems. That is what it's all about. So it actually is the answer to our innermost yearning. This is the answer to the meaning of life. This is what the Buddha has. Full understanding of happiness and suffering. How to find a final solution to this. It is the answer to the meaning of life. Contemplate that, because it's incredibly powerful. When you understand that the Buddha's teaching is the answer to the meaning of life, if you really get that, there's nothing else to do. Yeah, if you say, yeah, the meaning of life, okay, forget about that now, I'm going to go back to work, you know. It doesn't make any sense, yeah? If you found the meaning of life, you don't think, yeah, I'm going to do something else. That is what matters. And you start to change your life, and you start to look at things in a different way. This is what is so interesting about the teaching of the Buddha, is that it goes to the very core, the very essence of what it means to be human, what it means to be a human being, and it gives us the answer to the most meaningful things in existence. Once you get that, there's nothing else to be done, and you commit yourself, you persevere in this practice in a very different way as a consequence. So that is the knower of the world. Then you have the unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, or tameable people. So tameable just means that you are interested in Buddhist teachings. Yeah, that means that you are tameable because you are kind of heading in the right direction already. The Buddha is unsurpassed precisely because he has the full insight into happiness and suffering. So he has the full wisdom, the full understanding of what human life is about. But also he is the supreme teacher because he is driven by compassion. Compassion is what drives the Buddha. The Buddha is the only reason why the Buddha teaches is because of compassion. He has no other motivation in his life. There's nothing else that drives the Buddha. You can be skeptical about some teachers. Some teachers may teach because they think, yeah, when I teach, maybe they will give me a donation afterwards. Yeah, then I can build this or build that or whatever. Or some teacher may teach because the ego, yeah, I feel really good, yeah, when people, you know, being a teacher is really cool to kind of teach many people or whatever. There can be all kind of reasons why people teach. Or even if you are just a school teacher, you get a salary from it, yeah, so you have like a vested interest in that teaching job because people give you something in return. So for most people, there's a vested interest. In other words, they have a self-interest in that teaching. But for the Buddha, it's exactly the opposite. He has no vested interest. For the Buddha, it's a hassle. He doesn't want to teach anyone, yeah? Because teaching means he can't just relax and meditate. He can't just enjoy the bliss of jhanas or whatever. So instead of enjoying the bliss of jhanas, he has to come out and teach all these people. And sometimes they don't get it. And sometimes they ask stupid questions. Like, oh no, these people, what a headache. Yeah, to teach all these people. And so actually, it's hard work to teach people, especially if you are the Buddha, because you are starting out, you have no disciples. For me, it's quite easy, because you are already Buddhist, yeah, it's quite easy to teach, well, I think most of you are Buddhist anyway, but it's quite easy, because you're already open, you're already listening. The Buddha, he starts from scratch, nobody is a Buddhist. He has to convert people from ground zero. Imagine how difficult that is. Especially when the message is so profound. So for the Buddha, it's just a hassle. The only reason he teaches is because of compassion. There's no other motivation or driving force in his life. And there's something very beautiful about that, because when there is no vested interest like that, when there's nothing else that drives you, it's very pure. Yeah, it's very, very pure. He does it only for this one reason. He doesn't care if you listen to him or not. He doesn't care what the outcome is. He does it only for your benefit. And it means that when the Buddha gives a teaching, you listen with extra care, because you understand that he's teaching you only out of compassion, nothing else. So read the suttas. Remember, when you read the suttas, this is the Buddha talking to you. And he's teaching you out of compassion, out of kindness. He doesn't want anything from you. He wants absolutely nothing from you. In fact, he probably wants you to get enlightened as quickly as possible and get out of the way. That's probably what he wants. Yeah. So it is very pure. So read these things with that idea. Here, somebody very compassionate is teaching you. They are teaching you for your best interest. They are teaching you. And when you read it like that, it opens up your mind in a different way. Here is not someone who has their own agenda, trying to kind of convince you of something. It's purely out of compassion. It means that you read the suttas with more care. It means that if there's something you find difficult to understand, it means that you don't just reject it straight away. You put it to one side and allow it to mature a little bit. And maybe over time, it will make more sense later on. You read it, you contemplate it carefully. You reflect it carefully, because you know this probably is something very valuable for you. This is the right approach. This is how you should read the suttas in the right way. The suttas are not just to be read once and then put aside. There's something that you can reflect on and think about. Yeah, after these sutta readings, you can think about the suttas afterwards and reflect, what does this mean to me? And then as you do that, it sinks in a deeper way, and it becomes more meaningful in your own life as a consequence. This is what it means to be the supreme teacher, the compassion, the one who is coming purely from compassion and wisdom. And that's all that he is driving the Buddha, nothing else. So they're very pure, very powerful, very deep teachings. Okay. I'll go on a little bit longer. Is that okay? Are you happy to go on a bit longer? Yeah? Just finish off at least this one sentence. Otherwise, we'll be here forever. And we have to add a couple of more days to the retreat otherwise. So then we have the Buddha is the teacher of devas and humans. The idea that the Buddha is like the insight of the Buddha is above any kind of other insight. No other devas have the similar kind of insight. So even if there are devas around, just because they are magnificent and great and powerful in a certain way, doesn't mean that they necessarily have any wisdom. Wisdom is different. Glory and power is one thing. Wisdom is something else. See some of the human beings who have the most power in this world. You wonder if they have much wisdom. I shall say no more. I shall leave it at that. You can reflect for yourself. See what you think about that. So remember that, you know, just because you happen to be a deva, and maybe, you know, if you saw a deva, you probably would be pretty impressed. Yeah, lots of beautiful light and power and all those kind of things. It doesn't necessarily mean they have any wisdom. So the Buddha kind of goes on top of the hierarchy. The Buddha is where the wisdom is. My ancestral religion is the Nordic gods. You know about the Nordic gods? Thor, yeah, Thor and Odin, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so they're pretty kind of awe-inspiring gods. And every culture has these kind of gods. You find these gods, you have Chinese culture has these gods. In ancient Indian culture, you have these gods. In all the various European cultures, you have these gods. They're found everywhere. It's a common thing in humanity. And of course, I think that this is the reason why all cultures have these gods, is because they have tapped into a certain reality. There are beings like that. They actually do exist. And you create kind of religions out of it. This is how powerful they are. And then because they are so powerful, people believe in them and take them very seriously. But the Buddha says, no, you know, they may be powerful, but they may not have the insight. The Buddha is the teacher of gods and humans. That is where the real insight lies. The highest kind of insight. Anyway, the enlightened one, the blessed one, is the Buddha. So this is the verse, the Itipiso verse. And as I said, it is the verse that the Buddha uses to explain who he is. And as I mentioned, you will see everything there is about insight and understanding. Nothing there is about psychic powers. Nothing there about all these other kind of miraculous things. One of the things that you see is that the longer you come after the Buddha, the more kind of the way things develop after the time of the Buddha, you get more and more supernormal powers, more and more wonderful events, more and more marvelous things. So there is that development. The human mind likes these kind of cool things. It's like a bit of entertainment. You know what I mean? If somebody flies through the air, what is it? It's just entertainment, isn't it? Nothing more than that. It's pretty cool entertainment, but it's still just entertainment, really. It doesn't really get you anywhere. If somebody sinks into the ground or somebody reads your mind, it's like entertainment, because you see things that are, it's like a circus act in a sense. And it gives you, sometimes people think it gives you faith, but actually it doesn't really give you faith. It may give you faith for a short while, but it's a very superficial kind of faith. It's not a deep faith in the wisdom and understanding is something which is going to change your life. It's a very superficial thing. One of the things the Buddha said, this is in a sutta called the Kevada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, Long Discourses, number 11, I think it is, in the Long Discourses. And this is when the Buddha, he's in Nalanda, his town in India. And the people in Nalanda, they say to the Buddha, please get the monks to do psychic powers, because if the monks have psychic powers, people will get more faith. And the Buddha says, he says that I abhor, I detest, I find these psychic powers are disgusting. He was very, very strong language. And the Buddha says that, and what do people do today? They still are interested in psychic powers. The Buddha says the reason I say this is because those people who already have faith and confidence in Buddhism, they will say, look at these monks, they all have, or maybe the nuns as well, they have psychic powers. Wow, they are so powerful, their minds are really well developed. But those people who don't have faith and confidence, they wouldn't say, ah, yeah, this is just some kind of magic trick. Yeah, this is some kind of, I don't know who the great magicians are these days. Somebody just kind of using a magic trick to do these things. And of course, that's exactly what happens. People do magic tricks and they do these kind of things. And that's why the Buddha says, I detest these things. Psychic power is not what it's about. Psychic power is entertainment. It is something which is kind of cool to see. It doesn't have any lasting benefit. So forget about blooming psychic powers. Yeah, go to the essence of what Buddhism is about. It's about wisdom. It's about insight. Okay, if you do get to see, a bit of entertainment is good sometimes. If you do see some nice psychic powers, then great. But this is really not what it is about. So keep that in mind. And when you remember the Buddha as the compassionate one, the wise one, the one who has understood the answer to the meaning of life. That is really awesome. That is absolutely astonishing. The meaning of life is something that philosophers and religious people have contemplated since the beginning of human civilization. Yeah, it goes back thousands and thousands of years. Nobody has figured it out. If you look at kind of an ordinary psychology magazine in the present day, I was looking it up recently, there's a magazine called Psychology Today. And it said the meaning of life is whatever you make out of your life. That's the meaning of life. That's not the meaning of life. That's what you make out of it. That's very different from the meaning of life. So this is, after thousands of years of philosophizing, that's where we got to. You just give it meaning by living in a good way. And that's okay. But the Buddha says there actually is a meaning. There is an inherent meaning to life. If you live it in the right way, if you practice in the right way, you can find that. You can find the ultimate contentment, the ultimate happiness, the end of all suffering. You can find everything you ever wanted to find. Everything that your heart yearns for is there. It's available by practicing these teachings. That is the message of the Buddha. And that is why the Buddha's teachings are so special. You don't find that anywhere else. I say that anyway. You don't find that anywhere else. These teachings are unique in that sense. They have this incredible promise that take you to the very core, the very essence of what human life is all about. What a wonderful thing that is. And that is what you see when you start reading the suttas. And that is what we're going to be doing during the next 4 days or whatever it is left. This is what we're going to be doing, trying to get more of a grasp on how to achieve that meaning of life through practicing these teachings in the right way. So remember that you are in the presence of the meaning of life. That is awesome. It's kind of makes your hair stand on end if you think about it in the right way. And it gives you a basis for having a lot of joy and happiness as a consequence. Okay. So that is all for now. So keep on enjoying yourself and have a nice lunch, and we'll see you back here again at 3 p.m. this afternoon, hopefully.